That sounds great. Good afternoon. It is 3 o'clock, and I will call this meeting to order. The first thing we have on our agenda is, I do believe we have a quorum here. So the first thing, the minutes from the March 2025 meeting. I was wondering if Representative Lesnikar, if you would move the minutes.
Thank you, Chair. I reviewed the minutes, and I would so move them.
All right. We got a motion to move the minutes. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. We are now going to hear House File 1918. And this bill will be re-referred to the Judiciary Committee. Representative Hansen, or co-chair or co-vice chair. would you like to move the bill before the committee?
So moved, Mr. Chair, and my motion would be to re-refer this to the Judiciary Committee after this.
Okay. Well, thank you. And the bill is before us, and Representative Hansen, if you would please present your bill.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, committee members. House File 1918 is an agency bill for the Department of Children, Youth, and Families. So they are joining me today up here and can answer any questions that you have. For a lot of details, as always with policy bills, I'd point you to your packets if you're looking for any specific details, but we're also happy to answer any questions. I'm going to run through each of the articles here very briefly to just give you a preview of what each article is about, and then I'll turn it back to you, Chair, to go over questions. So starting in Article 1, this is an economic assistance provision. This is seeking to extend or exempt the contract term limit for the EBT contract. And so this is providing an exemption to the 5-year limit on state contracts for the state's EBT contract, which is the electronic benefits transfer. It's allowing them to then do an initial 5-year term extension up to 10 years total. So in other words, this is a good government provision because it tries to streamline something so they're not spending as much time renewing contracts and having the opportunity to deliver services more often. Article 2 is about child care provider programs. This particular piece will make sure that the Great Start Compensation Support Payment Program policy is updated to be sure to clarify which data is collected in administering this program, is if the data is public or not public. And so just being very clear about that, there were some questions along those lines. Article 3 is the child welfare section. So there are some housekeeping, technical, and policy updates here, so I'll kind of run through those. This is going to clarify some requirements around the Minnesota African American Family Preservation and Child Welfare Disproportionality Act to support its implementation. This is adding clarifying language to clearly state that the inquiry of American Indian heritage is required for all children and all families in any kind of child welfare setting and matter. This has replaces some weird language that's in there and replaces it with like official terminology. We think that's important, so it's not just some kind of colloquial language there. Article 3 also corrects a statutory cross-reference. It aligns another statute with the guidance that the department recommends related to the reestablishment of parental rights, and it allows for a child who is not currently adopted to be reunified with a biological parent through reestablishment of parental rights, including a child whose prior adoption dissolved. And it also allows parents whose consent adoption was accepted by the court to be eligible for reestablishment if the identified prospective adoptive parent did not finalize the adoption or if the adoption dissolved. Lastly, in this piece of the housekeeping parts, it aligns the statute with DCYF guidance about clarifying the timeline and the information gathering authority and the documentation requirements for the agencies who are conducting non-caregiver human trafficking assessments. This also is going to, in sections, same Article 3, but sections 6 and 28, these particularly are about supporting and preserving families to prevent foster care placement. So we've talked a lot about that in this committee, and I just wanted to unpack this particular piece a little bit more. So this is going to allow the counties and tribes to have a more of a preventional response to educational neglect reports prior to a child protection response. So current statute requires a child protection response at 7 unexcused absences. And we know, and I know this from my upbringing, that unexcused absences can also be related to poverty or other needs that the families have. You know, a lot of times these things get confused with child neglect, and we want to support families with the supports that they need. And so this is going to allow the counties and tribes to respond in a more preventative, holistic, and really like engagement manner with the families before it going to like a maltreatment response type of situation. Hopefully this is, the goal of this is to improve the engagement and the attendance at the same time while engaging the family. But we're also decreasing some of those unnecessary child protection interactions as much as possible. Now, if those unexcused absences continue, that obviously the statute would not change that. It is still a child protection response for these unexcused absences. They will continue if they go past that after the intervention. Let's see. So then let's move on to the foster care policy modifications. These are spread through sections 10, 13 to 15, 17 to 18, and 23 to 24. But there's two things that you really want to know about these. So the statute requires that out-of-home placement plans are prepared 30 days after a child is placed in foster care. But this is going to align us with federal statutes for out-of-placement plans to be 60 days. So it's easier on our staff and workers when things, you know, 30 for one, 60 for the other. So this would align that. But still maintaining the policy goals that we've worked on in the legislature over the last few years to try to still get it done within the 30 days whenever it's possible. The next piece is for youth in foster care at age 17 and a half. Our current policy requires that the agency provide a notice to the youth, parents, and others about any extended foster care programs. And this proposal here adds a court review and court report and a review 90 days prior to turning 18 to inform the court of the youth's intentions and to ensure all needs or services are being addressed there as well. All right, moving on to Article 4, which I believe is the last article, if I remember right. This is about transfers to DCYF, and it provides that any power, duty, or responsibility that's given to the Commissioner of Human Services or the Department of Human Services is in an uncodified sections of law, that these duties get transferred over to DCYF. That's the easiest way to explain that. They can definitely answer more questions about that, but I do think that folks who are concerned about the transfers should definitely read that piece of it as well. And with that, I will turn it over to the committee to ask any questions of the fabulous DCYF folks who are here to help me today. Thank you.
I think let's go with the DCYF. I don't know if you have anything you want to add or if we should go right to member questions.
Mr. Chair, Nick Demp, for the record, I think Rep. Hansen did a fabulous job providing an overview, so if folks have questions, we're happy to answer any questions folks have.
Yes, she did. Thank you. So, Chair Katiza-Watoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just wanted to clarify quick about the out-of-home placement plan and the summary. So it looked like the summary is still within that 30-day window, but then the actual placement plan extends to a 60-day window. One of the things that I think we had talked to some of the caseworkers down in Scott County on our visit, Representative Hansen, was that depending on the situation, oftentimes the family can be reunited before we hit that 60-day mark. So it is not only does it align with federal requirements, but then makes it easier on our caseworkers in the case that the issue is resolved before having to do all that paperwork. Okay, thank you.
Representative Hansen, do you want to?
Yes, that is correct. And we know that our caseworkers are already really bogged down, and we understand that caseloads are really high right now. And so pushing for this 30-day, you know, we want to have at least like a plan if it's needed within that 30 days still, but trying to push for that when, like you said, a lot of times families do get reunited in that time because that those relationships are going well and they just got the support they needed, that it would allow them to not have to rush to get as much of that done. But still, again, I don't want that to come across as it being that they want to push it out and take more time as if it's not important to get done in a timely manner either, right? For situations where it does need to be done faster, obviously that all stays the same too. So.
Representative Nadeau.
Remember to turn that on this time.
And maybe I was reading this and I wasn't totally paying attention, but my question is in 16.1, it's on OHP. Is a 60-day planning, is that what you were talking about, Representative Katizawatun? Okay. So I have the same question, and I think I want a broader answer, or maybe a more specific answer. That's what I want. So this is changing so that this is OHP plan doesn't have prepared within 60 days for after any child is placed in foster care under 260C. So is that to give that foster care placement a time that child to stabilize? Tell me how this is impacting a child when that's my question, because this is new.
There's high chew action happening, I see.
Sorry.
That's okay.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair. And Representative Nadeau, would you like me to go into that, or would you like to hear from the department? I just want to be clear and for the sake of time.
I'm happy
Representative Nadeau.
Representative Hansen.
Great. So thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Nadeau. So removing this requirement for an out-of-home placement plan to be prepared within the 30 days after the placement and then adding that to be aligned with the statute, if I'm working with a family and they need services, you know this as well as I do, so I definitely want to recognize that I'm preaching to the choir when I give you this answer. But if they need more services, whether it's MFIP or cash assistance or something like that, it's probably going to take me longer than 30 days to even get all of that approved, right? But if they meet the requirements of what their reunification plan says within that 30 days, we obviously are going to follow that reunification plan above all else, right, if they've met the requirements. But if there is this out-of-home placement plan that's being prepared, while the family's still working their case, that 60 days is going to give them more time to work their reunification plan. Right now, if you only have 30 days to work your reunification plan while you're waiting for MFIP, waiting for cash assistance, waiting for whatever services or supports you need, it is a pretty fast timeline, both for the worker to try to turn around and the family. And so this giving them that 60 days to align with what the federal statute requires is good for families and good for workers. I think that's the answer you were looking for. I hope that was the more information, but happy to add them in if we need to.
Representative.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Hansen. So there's nothing in here that prevents a case manager to start working on this. I just want to make sure that we don't end up, you know, not starting until 60 days, and a child is, you know, kind of left. We're hopeful and thoughtful, and all of a sudden we get to 60 days rather than 30 days, and the child is still incredibly unstable. And so I think I'm fine with that. I want to go to 9.8, and this is on habitual truant. And this is a big deal right now.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think I'm fine with the language being added. There's a lot of work being done in truancy. There's a lot of efforts that are being made to find out where this data is being transmitted to, and then who is going to be responsible to try to reach out to those parents and or educators or, you know, whomever to try to get those kids back in school. So With that short, brief thing, tell me how this language add, why it's important, and how it's going to help us ensure that we have less truant kids and we get them back in school faster. And if there's no connection, you can totally tell me that, too.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Nadeau. I think my personal opinion on this, just my like background and what I've worked on, I think helping the families identify what their needs are and being able to do a needs conversation with the family before we open a whole maltreatment case is, one, a better use of government resources so that the staff can focus on the cases that do need their every single day safety issues. That's my opinion. I don't know if the department would agree with me or not, but we want to make sure that those safety issues are getting as much time as necessary. Knowing that caseloads are really tight right now, that's part of it. But these maltreatment cases require a whole lot more information rather than just sitting down with mom and dad and saying, hey, your kid's been gone 7 days. How can we support you and get this stuff in there and do educational connections with the family too? We always know including the family in these things is the best way. So similar to what I mentioned before, that sometimes poverty is recognized as neglect. Similarly here, a kid missing 7 days of school is like, it may not be neglect. If it is, then that's the path that will immediately begin. But sometimes it's like, well, I didn't know my kid had to go every day, or I didn't have to go to school every day when I was a kid. And maybe it's just informing them about the importance. Maybe it's that the kid has a chronic condition and maybe the family needs more supports. You know, I think there'll be really good conversations that come out of that as opposed to having to open the whole maltreatment case. Now, if they get in with the family and there's something else not related to the 7 days that's going on, this does not stop any of that from starting. That's going to continue because it's a new information, new news, if you will. But when it's just the 7 days in a row, that these be educational conversations as opposed to full maltreatment cases. The chair has changed.
Representative Nadeau.
And thank you, Chair West, and thank you, Representative Hansen. So, I mean, I differ in my opinion a little bit. I mean, we have educational neglect that in my, you know, in a lot of cases, I mean, we never do it. And I'm not saying that we should. But it's, we have increasing truancy, like, everywhere. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, will this give us more teeth to try to get kids in school? And again, tell me if that's not the intent of this, then just say that's not the intent, and I will work on something else.
Vice Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you again, Representative Nadeau. I would say that is everybody's intent to keep our kids in school as much as possible. So I think that's the goal of everybody on this committee, most parents I know as well. But for the parents that need some other kind of educational support, I do think it's important we just ask them where they're at and so that we can meet them where they're at rather than in a child protection situation. Again, it's not always that someone whose kid is gone for 7 days. It's always because of neglect or maltreatment, right? And so opening that as a default, I think, is where the issue is and why I think this is important. I know, for example, like my daughter had really painful periods, and it was hard for her to go to school all the time. And so if this had come up, that would have been the conversation I, as a mom, had with the Child Protection Department. And maybe they could have, you know, had some suggestions for things like that, but at least having the conversation. It's not always that kids are being maltreated if they miss 7 days. And so I just think automatically jumping to that step, that there's a better kind of interim half step that we could make. But I think the goal is that we always are encouraging our kids to go as much as possible.
Representative Doe.
My final question on this section is specifically on line 9.17. where I'm not a lawyer, but I do know that clear and convincing evidence is a legal framework. And so can you tell me why that legal language has been put on that line in this statute? It's line 9.17.
Vice Chair Hansen.
Thank you very much. I'm going to phone a friend on that question because I, too, am not a lawyer. So I'm going to ask if the department can come in. I will say Jennifer's filling in today for somebody who would normally be the expert at this section, but she's going to do amazing. I'm really confident in that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate that.
Can please introduce yourself for the record. Yeah, answer your the wonderful question. And could you move the microphone so it's there?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'll have to get back to you on why that particular piece of language was used. I'm not sure if it aligns with language that's already in statute, but I know this language was worked on with very closely with counties, intended to try to make sure that we were providing the best possible response to families to help keep their children in school. But I can certainly look into that and get back to you.
Okay,
thank you. Nonpartisan, Ms. Sunderman.
Mr. Chair and members, this language is also found in Chapter 260C, so this aligns 260E with the clear and convincing requirements in 260C point 163, subdivision 11.
Okay. Representative Nadeau.
My last question, and this is on Article 1 in Economic Assistance, 1.19 to 1.25, is, and Mike, I think this is a pretty easy question. So it's basically where it looks like we're setting aside normal state contract requirements. And are we setting that aside for the credit card processing firm, the company that loads EBT cards? Is that what we're setting it aside for?
Vice Chair Hansen or other testifier?
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Dan.
Representative, we're basically setting aside the five-year contract limit for our contract overall. So this will allow us to have a longer runway, essentially, to do that procurement process. What we've seen is it's just taking a couple of years to get through that entire process. And so with the current five-year term limit, we're executing a contract and then a couple years later doing it all over again. So it's just an inefficient process. So if we have 10 years, that will allow us to not be turning around every couple of years and doing a re-procurement of that same contract.
Representative Nadeau.
And you obviously know better than I do, but DHS requires us to do RFPs for community-based services all the time. I mean, that's just part of our job. It's part of making sure that we're being transparent, we're being accountable, we're finding the best providers out there for the best prices. I think those things are put in place for a reason. I recognize that it may be difficult to acquire these contracts, but I wonder if it's prudent. And so it's a judgment call that I'm asking you to make, and I guess I'm concerned with that. This is a very large contract.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Dem.
Representative, just to clarify, we would still be doing a competitive RFP with this language. It's just allowing us to have a longer contract duration.
Yep, and I understand that.
Representative Nadeau, final follow-up.
Okay.
It's the first time I've ever done that.
Thank you.
Representative Hicks, final follow-up.
I will be super.
Sorry.
He got like 10.
Yeah, you know.
Then two words.
12.
Okay. Representative Hansen, I don't know if this is the case for the attendance piece in your bill, but I would just like to share that I have had so many conversations with families where they're like, we have a referral to child welfare because our child hasn't been in school, but we don't really know what's happening because we drop them off and they seem to lose them. And by lose them, I mean the child doesn't go to class. I mean the child walks away. I mean the teenager makes a decision. All of those things are very annoying. But not really within a parental control. If you're taking your kid and you're dropping them off at the front door and you watch them walk in and then somehow. And so I know Representative Keeler is doing a lot of work in the attendance space, and there's a lot of work happening in that space. But I do think it's important that we just sort of recognize that there's more, especially with middle school and high schoolers, there's a lot more to attendance than just parental involvement. Sometimes the most involved parents can still not understand why the phone rings at 5:03 every day about someone has not been in a class. It's the strangest thing that happens. And it's not because we're not involved. It's not because parents don't care. It's simply because teenagers are teenagers. God help us all.
All right. Seeing no further member questions, except I am happy to see the Great Start Compensation Program restates existing law. It's great to get that information related to that program. And now we can do it much easier, and that's terrific. All right, Vice Chair Hansen, why don't you close us out?
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, committee members. I don't have any questions, but I do encourage you to have any questions you do come up with directed to the department. They're fabulous. I work in a lot of committees, and they're my favorite. Don't tell any other agency I said that, though. Thank you.
All right, Vice Chair Hansen renews her motion that House File 1918 be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary. Was it made? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails, and the bill is on its way to Judiciary. Representative Gilman. Good to see you before our committee for the second time.
Hey.
All right.
Thanks for inviting me back.
House file. I will move House File 2191 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative Gilman, to your bill.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you, Chair. So I get the pleasure of carrying the Office of Inspector General Children's Policy Bill, House File 2191. So it is a very technical bill, and we brought a DE forward, and I would just love to turn it over to the amazing Ari to give us a little bit more background on this bill.
All right. I will move the DE1 amendment before the committee, and would love to hear from the department. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ari Didion, Legislative Director for the DHS Office of Inspector General. And you'll have to forgive me, I am in my teenage boy era today with a cold. thank you, Chair West, Chair Kitizuwatun, for hearing our children's policy bill, and thank you to Representative Gilman for authoring the DE amendment. I will just run through that. Article 1, sections 1 and 3 are technical corrections related to a previously passed change to move child care to a continuous license process. This just makes it clear which licenses are on that continuous process and which ones continue to be updated on a two-year cycle for the time being. Then in sections, 2, 6, 9, and 13, these are related to federal compliance for the Child Care Development Fund, and these simply state the number of hours required for these trainings. They don't add any new additional trainings. They don't change the topics. This was just based on a federal requirement that we post the number of hours. So we base that number of hours on the existing training requirements so that folks that shouldn't have to go above and beyond what they're already required. And then sections, let me see here, 4, 5, 18, and 14 are related to the Department of Public Safety's child passenger restraint systems training. They updated that training last year, and so this makes changes to licensing statute to reflect those changes, including that it's required for children up to age 9 rather than 8, and also the training has become available in some different formats. And then section 7 of Article 1 in the amendment is just a technical change related to a previous change. There was a section that was overlooked when this was passed, so that's just a conforming change. And then there are also sections 10, 11, and 12. These are for certified centers, so these are for those license-exempt centers, typically the school-based programs or YMCAs that don't need a child care center license, but require a certification. And this just clarifies some basic health and safety things related to first aid and CPR training for these. It also requires that if they are put on a conditional certification, that they have to post that publicly. And so these just kind of align to be more similar to how things are for child care, for licensed child care centers. And that is Article 1. And then Article 2 of the DE, these provisions are related to DHS's proposal to prohibit kickbacks in the child care assistance program and in the medical assistance program. And so a kickback is anything of value that's offered as an incentive for folks to choose a specific provider in CCAP or MA. And so this adds a prohibition in both child care assistance statute and a new criminal penalty for kickbacks. And with that, I can stand for any questions.
Thank you for your presentation of that amendment. So we will move any member discussion to the DE1? All right. Seeing no discussion on DE1, we will move to a vote. All those in favor of the DE1, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. The bill is in the shape you would wish it. I actually have a question on the kickback language. So I'm actually due a wonderful kickback from my daycare for referring somebody there. Does this have any impact on referrals and then getting money for said referral?
Mr. Chair, there are some exceptions in the CCAP language for discounts because there are certain circumstances in which child care providers can provide a discount. So I wouldn't be able to say offhand if that would be considered a kickback or not, but we do have some exceptions in the child care language because that is a common practice.
Okay, that sounds about right because it's a 1 week, so I don't get cash money, but I do get $435. My goodness, child care is insane. Representative Hemmingson-Yeager.
Thank you, Chair. I just happened to be like reading it as you were talking about it, but as I'm looking on like 16.23 to 16.26, it says that like it does not apply to marketing promotional offers that directly benefit an applicant or recipient, and then discount scholarships or other financial assistance. So for what that's worth.
Thank you, Representative Hemmingson-Yeager. Representative Katiza Watum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a little bit of a question, and then I just have a little bit of a soapbox moment here, because as a former foster parent, the changes in Subdivision 8 about the child passenger restraint systems, a training requirement, I want to flag for people, and I know that we changed the seatbelt law last year, so this is just a conforming situation, but for parents who are opening up their home to foster children, there's a lot of background work that has to be done, and I think, you know, in the spirit of the language for car seat restraints last year that we passed is that we're keeping all children safer for longer in the proper seats. But I just want to highlight, right, that biological parents who can get pregnant naturally and have a baby and do, you know, grow their family as planned without any outside help or opening up their family to kinship care or, a foster adoptive child placement potentially don't have to do these types of trainings. And so I want to just call out again that we hold a certain subset of our children to a higher safety standard than we hold the rest of the children in the state of Minnesota. You know, we've had a lot of debate previously on the House floor about safe gun safety. Foster parents in their home study are required to already lock ammunition and weapons separately and securely. We did that in our home. I wouldn't have been able to have children if I did not lock my guns and my ammunition separately and safely. But we don't require the rest of the parents, biological parents in the state of Minnesota, to do that. We don't require biological parents in the state of Minnesota to go through a car seat training. They are going to have kids in cars. And I just, changing this from 8 to 9, I guess, just puts another year on it if you're going to be working with a slightly older child in your family that you have to go through that training potentially for a second time because it's required every 5 years. And I just wanted to take this opportunity to point this out and that maybe we have future discussions about getting biological parents some of the education that they need without potentially requiring or mandating it. But thank you for listening to me, and I will sign off my soapbox.
Any comment on that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will just add that one thing that is added with the new training is that they have an online option now for actually taking the course, and then it would just be the certification that's in person. So this change does make those trainings a little bit more accessible, and this does not just apply to child foster care. It applies to any programs that serve children, but can totally appreciate why that would be frustrating for foster parents. But we want to make sure that kids in those homes are safe.
Having to repeat the training every 5 years seems kind of awkward to me because it's a pretty hard thing to forget. Representative Hicks.
And trying to get into the training every 5 years.
Well, maybe we can do something about that, or maybe it's federal law. Everything we want to do here is barred by federal law. And I forgot to mention, Ms. Didion, thank you for starting with a joke. That's exactly what we want in this committee. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this one is simple. I'm just curious. On line 4.22, and this is under the documented technical assistance, it appears as though you're striking language that limits the agency from publishing documented technical assistance on the department's website. Does that mean now you're going to publish this on your website? What are we doing?
Ms. Didion.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nadeau, when I look at that, I'm actually realizing that that may have been related to one of our budget proposals. So other language that is not in here, that there is in the DHS budget bill there, or actually I think this will be in the DCYF budget, there's a federal compliance piece related to what we have to post on licensing lookup. And so the feds said we were out of compliance. We weren't posting all of the relevant visit information. And so that's what that change was actually related to. I think it got left in with my those training hours changes.
Ms. Didion, I had a different reading of that. So maybe I want to see if it's my understanding. This is under in lieu of a correction order for when they give technical assistance, to where if they publish the technical assistance they gave, it kind of still dings them like the correction order, and not publishing it makes it so the problem's fixed without kind of advertising the problem because it wasn't that large of a deal. That was my reading of it. Am I mistaken in some way, Ms. Didion?
Mr. Chair, I can follow up on this one. Yeah, it was my understanding that this one was related to an actually a different proposal that would have us posting visit summaries to our licensing information lookup. So, but I can check back with my folks and get some more detail for the committee.
Well, if not, I made up a good reason for it. I like it for that. Representative Nadeau, anything else? Any other member questions or discussion? All right, Representative Gilman, feel free to close out your bill.
Great. Thank you so much, committee, for hearing this important agency bill. We're excited to get this moving and get it in the shape it needed to be in. Thanks.
All righty. Thank you, Representative Gilman. And with that, I will lay over House File 2191 as amended for possible inclusion in a later omnibus bill. And now we are on to Representative Knutson, who brought water for the committee. Chair Katiza Watoon.
It looks like she brought some adorable children to committee, which is always welcome.
That I did.
That definitely counts. Are we allowed to? I will move House File 897 before the committee and to be referred to the Committee on Public Safety. Representative Knutson, to your bill.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you, Chair Katiza Watoon, as well. House File 897 aligns the criminal penalty for exposing children and vulnerable adults to fentanyl with current statutes for exposure to methamphetamine. Unfortunately, the need for this legislation has been born out of many tragic but preventable situations, including the death of an 18-month-old this past Christmas Day right here in St. Paul. I think that in your packets, there are a couple different articles relating to those deaths. I do have testifiers with me, and I'd like to turn it over to them.
So please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon, co-chairs. It's a pleasure to be here today. I want to thank the author for your leadership on this legislation. I want to thank your committee for taking the time to consider this critically important and frankly long overdue correction, I would call it, to our legislation addressing the dangers of narcotics in the vicinity of children. It is certainly our hope that following this hearing today, this bill can proceed with broad bipartisan support. I am the chair of Fentanyl-Free Communities. We are a nonpartisan and a non-ideological organization, and we are laser-focused on saving lives that we are losing to fentanyl through advocacy, education, and awareness. We are a powerful partnership between former elected officials, public safety leaders, and parents who have lost loved ones to fentanyl. Our goal is to ensure that institutions throughout Minnesota, including the Minnesota Legislature, enact best practices and direct resources wherever needed to address this epidemic. I am a former elected official, having served as Minneapolis City Council President 20 years ago in a different era. More importantly for today's discussion, I am a career prosecutor, and I was the chief narcotics trafficking prosecutor in Anoka County for the last decade of my legal career. I saw firsthand the toll of fentanyl on our communities. I prosecuted fentanyl dealers, and I worked with the families of victims whose children were poisoned by fentanyl. In January of this year, our policy committee developed our legislative agenda, which was approved subsequently by FFC's board of directors. One of the priority issues on our agenda is heightened criminal penalties for parents or caretakers of juveniles who expose children to fentanyl. Our full agenda is available on our website, fentanylfreecommunities.org, and includes, as our number one priority, fully funding the state's Narcan portal, which is the most effective way to reduce fentanyl poisoning deaths in our state. Sadly, that portal is currently inactive because of lack of funding. We are ready to partner with any legislators and assist in garnering support for any legislation that will save lives we are losing to fentanyl poisoning in Minnesota. The legislation before you today, frankly, is what I would characterize as a no-brainer. I have successfully prosecuted caretakers of children and vulnerable adults under the current statute for exposing children to methamphetamine, including one case that reached the Court of Appeals. But let's get real. While exposure to methamphetamine by a child can be life-threatening, exposure to the poison that is fentanyl is a likely death sentence. This problem, as Representative Knutson has pointed out, is growing exponentially. According to the U.S. Poison Center, infant exposure to fentanyl increased 449% between 2020 and 2023. Think about it for a moment. If 2 milligrams, a couple of grains of salt, can kill a fully grown adult, what amount might kill an infant? Even a mere remnant of a pill or a trace amount of cocaine laced with fentanyl can kill a small child. Fentanyl-free communities is a strong proponent of treatment, police-initiated diversion and deflection, as well as harm reduction. There must also, however, be a place in society and for this legislature to state unequivocally that if you endanger the life of a precious child or infant or vulnerable adult, there will be criminal consequences. After all, the protection of those unable to protect themselves must continue to be a fundamental value in our state. Thanks again for the opportunity to address you today.
Thank you, Mr. Ostro. We have a remote testifier now, Carrie Sheldon.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Carrie Sheldon. Thank you for the opportunity to speak on this issue. I have been hoping to that a bill addressing this issue has finally come forth. My PCA and I have witnessed and smelled fentanyl daily on the train. The smell gives me a headache and makes me dizzy. I've had to yell at people to get out of my way because they are so stoned, I would have to have no choice but to run them over with my wheelchair. I have also seen animals get physically sick because it is their first instinct to smell and lick the ground. The riders don't seem to care about the audio riders or warnings, and there is not enough police presence on the trains. I understand that there is a security risk even for the police, but more of a presence needs to happen. The only police presence my PCA and I have seen are during sports activities. People need the train to get to work and to get to and from work, and they don't need to be stoned or smell of illegal drugs by the time they get to work. Metro Transit Customer Relations says that they will have police presence, but it never happens. Most of the drug activity is during the afternoon and evening. it's bad enough that I must smell legal marijuana as well. As far as the smoke, as smoking the drugs in apartment buildings, managers don't seem to understand that at all. We sign a lease, but it still goes on. They just expect you to find another place to live. Finding Section 8 housing, apartments that are easily physically and financially accessible is not that easy. I should also not have to move when I have lived at my place for over 34 years. Please support House File 897. Thank you for listening to my testimony.
Thank you, Ms. Sheldon. We have another remote testifier, Sebastian Mesa.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. Sorry, looks like I got muted. As stated, my name is Sebastian Mesa. I'm an assistant Aiken County attorney. And I thank Representative Knutson for advancing this bill, HF 897, which, as the former speaker, Mr. Ostro, said, really closes an obvious gap in the law. 152.137 provides protection to children and vulnerable adults from methamphetamine. There is simply no common sense reason that we shouldn't extend that protection to cover fentanyl as well. Just quickly, looking at Minnesota Department of Health figures, between the years of 2010 and 2019, opioid deaths less than doubled. They went from 229 to 427. And then from 2019 to 2022, through the pandemic, those numbers more than doubled. They jumped to 1,039. Recently, those numbers have come down rather encouragingly because of Narcan, and the efforts of law enforcement and medical personnel. I think more awareness is growing too about the danger of fentanyl, but what hasn't changed is the pervasiveness of that new drug. In almost every fatal overdose, fentanyl seems to be involved. In non-fatal overdoses, again, fentanyl seems to be involved. It is easy to mix with other drugs. It is, as Mr. Ostro pointed out, potent in extremely small amounts, and so the danger to children is exponentially greater than it is with a drug like methamphetamine. Furthermore, fentanyl can be ingested in any number of ways. It can be injected, it can be smoked, it can even be absorbed through the skin. So fentanyl, to put it shortly, is at present probably the most lethal and dangerous street drug that is available. It is harming our communities, threatening the health of Minnesotans, and particularly children and vulnerable adults who are not able to protect themselves from exposure. So I encourage this committee to advance Representative Knutson's bill and to include fentanyl in Chapter 152.137 as the bill proposes. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mesa. Are there any members of the public who wishes to testify on House File 897? Seeing none, I'll close public testimony and move on to member questions. Members, Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much, Chair, and thank you for this. I was just checking with folks because I didn't know the answer. Since this involves vulnerable adults, is it going to go to Human Services?
Representative Knutson.
As of now, thank you, Chair. As of now, Representative Hicks, I am not aware of that.
Okay.
So Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much, Chair. I'm supportive. I'm a little, the reason I was asking is because people in substance use disorder, if they're receiving county services, are considered vulnerable adults. And so part of my question about the language is, as it's currently written, I'm a little concerned about a vulnerable adult and another vulnerable adult. If one vulnerable adult is active in substance use, that they would be held liable for being in the same space as another vulnerable adult. And I'm not saying that we should or we shouldn't do that. I'm just saying when we get into the VA statutes, things get a little complicated, and I just want to make sure that we're not creating anything, especially in the communal living spaces of, like, housing supports and services where we house people in sober homes and things like that. If those people are receiving county case management or SPMI case management or on a waiver under the statute that defines a vulnerable adult, they would be considered a vulnerable adult. So just kind of wanted to make sure that we clear through human services and make sure we're not, you know, stepping on anything that we shouldn't be stepping in.
Representative Knutson.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for your concern for that. As far as I know, and maybe my testifiers could comment on this, but this has been working well for methamphetamine, even in those situations, without any incident. So,
if I could,
Mr. Austin, jump in
on that. I would agree with Representative Knutson's analysis there. I don't have the definition off the top of my head, but I believe there's a specific definition for vulnerable adults in the criminal statutes that may be different from the one you're referring to, which I think is based more on county licensing and others. So I certainly could try to provide more information on that. But based on I'm a retired prosecutor, but based on my memory, I do think there might be a distinction there that would clarify your question.
And just to piggyback off of that, I am a current prosecutor. Oh, sorry, Mr. Chair, thank you for recognizing me. This proposed bill does not change any of the language in 152.137 other than to include fentanyl. Methamphetamine, as you all know, can also be prescribed. It can be prescribed for ADHD, which, you know, I happen to suffer from. Not to say that I'm on methamphetamine, but it can also be used as a weight loss drug. That doesn't mean, you know, that we're going to be out there prosecuting people for having weight loss drugs in the same home where children are or in facilities where vulnerable adults might be. And I would just add that I think that the concern for the definition of vulnerable adult is well taken. It is the definition that exists under 609.232 subdivision 11. So that is a criminal statute, but it does refer to individuals receiving home care who are licensed under sections 144A, 43 to 80, 482. So that it's a well-placed concern, but I would say that it's already addressed by the bill, it's addressed by the existing statute, and it's the concerns there are no different for fentanyl than they are for methamphetamine. I would put it at that. Thank you.
I think it's an interesting thing to consider. I'd say knowingly exposed, I would think, would be enforced in a way to where it's like, that's knowingly exposing, but just having it in the presence. But that is something that I encourage you to consult as we go through the process and make sure it's all sewn up there. Chair Katisa-Watoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Knutson, for bringing this bill forward. I think it's definitely something that we need to have a conversation about and look very seriously at. I know you've already heard the bill previously in public safety, and we're going to be returning you to public safety. Chair Mueller had let me know that there was some conversation about a medical exemption and including that in statute. And I'm just curious. I know it's not currently in the statute, but I think that particularly, some of the statewide, not here in Minnesota, but elsewhere, statutory changes that we've seen, particularly around reproductive freedom in other states, physicians have found themselves in a very difficult moral decision on whether or not they risk their license potentially to help a patient who might be going through a pregnancy, ectopic pregnancy, something along those lines, where they might be running afoul, potentially providing a termination at that point. So I think that we just have to be really careful and make sure that if it's intended that we have a medical exemption, that we do consider putting that into statute. So perhaps your testifier has thoughts.
Mr. Representative Knutson.
Thank you, Chair West. Thank you for bringing that up. We have talked about that. fentanyl, just like methamphetamine, is a Schedule II drug. So that's already covered under this law, any of those issues. So thank you.
Good. Yeah. Representative Altendorf.
Thank you, Chair West, and thank you, Representative Knutson, for bringing this bill. This is just more of a comment, but it's really important that we are focusing there. I think your testifier said this is really a no-brainer. Last summer, I was invited to Minneapolis, an area that's a very difficult area to live, a very poor area. There was a group called Operation Hug the Block. They're trying to bring attention and recognition to the violence that's happening in the area. There's homelessness. There are people dying. And I said, what is the number one problem? What is the number one problem that's happening here in Minneapolis? And all of them said, fentanyl. It's the drug dealers, it's fentanyl. And we need to put our focus in this area, absolutely, because it is totally ruining so many communities. Thank you.
Representative Sensimura.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Knutson, for bringing this bill. I agree, fentanyl is a huge, huge issue. I think I have a question because I was familiar with the articles that we have in those cases, and that was kind of more of the direction that I thought the bill was going. I heard the testimony and saw the letter included about concerns around fentanyl on trains, and fentanyl use on the light rail is a huge, huge concern in my community. But I guess I was imagining more of a situation where a parent has fentanyl, you know, a kid ingests it, and then that parent would be prosecuted. Can you speak to, how would it work on trains, right? We do have people who are smoking fentanyl on the trains. I know that makes me and other people scared to ride those trains with kids, but how would that actually play out with this language around exposing someone to fentanyl? I mean, train cars can be very large. If someone's at one end and I'm at the other, does that count as exposing? If you could just talk through some of that. Thank you.
Representative Knutson.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you, Representative Sensimura. That was not a situation that this was targeting. This was targeting more of that vulnerable adult at home or a child at home, as in these articles. I think it could be very hard to address that issue on a crowded train, just in general public, out in, you know, in the community, wherever you are, because you don't know where the source is. You don't know who has it or how it got in the air or on a surface or whatever. So that's not what this is targeting. This is targeting those in-home situations or those residential situations, those areas where children or vulnerable adults are living, residing, being.
If I could add to that, the language expose is one that, as is often the case with any statute, one that if there was a case that went to trial, there'd probably be some discussion about what that meant. I think a case can be made. It's a narrower definition than having fentanyl in the presence of a child, which, in other words, theoretically could be anywhere in the house. So at least I can envision a circumstance. I think I agree generally with Representative Knutson, but I certainly could see a circumstance where there are infants on a train, on a light rail train, and people are literally ingesting fentanyl, right next door to those children, and clearly exposing those children. Is there a fact scenario where it could apply? Yes. Is it something that would happen a lot? No. But I, in an extreme example, I think it might.
Representative Sensimura.
Thank you, Chair, and thanks for that clarification. Just because it was brought up in the testimony, I thought it was important to talk through. Thank you.
Vice Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Chair. And I share the concerns of Representative Sensimura because when I'm looking through the fiscal note, it's one of the biggest ones I've seen that come through here. So thank you for being thorough on that. But I don't see one from public safety. And so I think that would be, and I know this is going back there, so it's really not my problem, and I'm probably overstepping right now.
True.
But I just want to make sure that we're aware of that if the intention, back to the point, is about trains and stuff, and maybe this links back to the language in the bill on 2.1, 1.4 and 1.5, the be exposed to part, maybe just expand on that a little bit more. Maybe that might help with that, because I would imagine public safety would have a pretty big opinion about having to enforce that on the train or one of the metro officers there too. And I'm kind of curious and maybe there's a legal language for this, not a lawyer, said that earlier twice today now, but not a lawyer. And maybe there's a legal definition of what be exposed to means, but if there isn't, maybe we could expand on that or consider taking that. Because I agree, inhaling, having contact with ingesting, overdosing, any of those things on the same page, but I think this be exposed to part might be a little broad for my understanding at least. Thank you.
I think we have a clarification coming from Mr. Mesa.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the posed question, what it really boils down to is prosecutorial discretion and giving prosecutors the necessary tools to prosecute similarly situated defendants similarly. So exposing a child to methamphetamine as a caretaker, as a parent, currently carries a felony penalty under 152.137. Exposing them to fentanyl does not. As Mr. Ostro says, that part of it at least is absolutely a no-brainer. Why wouldn't that be felony behavior? It simply is. And so it's not that it requires enforcement on trains or anything of the nature. And subdivision two, the prohibited conduct, which it would fall under, no person may knowingly engage, in any of the following, and then knowingly cause or permit a child or vulnerable adult to inhale, be exposed to, have contact with, or ingest. That again goes to placing that child in danger. And there's other language in the statute which covers, where children are likely to be found. So again, as Mr. Ostro said, you can come up with a fact pattern where somebody on a train is in violation of this statute. You can do that for methamphetamine right now. If you have someone sitting next to a child smoking meth out of a pipe, and that child is exposed to that paraphernalia, that is felony level conduct under the statute, under our current laws. And all that we're asking for here and all that Representative Knutson is seeking is that fentanyl be considered in that same serious category as methamphetamine. Thank you.
All right. Really quick, members. We're actually pretty far afoul of the jurisdiction of this committee. So, okay. Vice Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Chair.
McDonald.
And I don't think anybody in this committee is saying it's not a no-brainer. So I just want to go on record and say, I think we just had questions given the testimony that was given. And it's easy enough to just say that's currently the statute for methamphetamine. So that's sufficient. Next time we'll make sure we ask House Research the question. But I appreciate that. And like I said, I don't think anybody on this committee has said or implied that this is not something we want to do or no-brainers. We're just asking questions. So thank you, Chair.
Representative McDonald.
Well, Mr. Chair, at the risk of going off far, I just think it's fair to say the fentanyl that has been coming into our country in the last 4 years has been through our borders, and that has been the deepest problem that America has been facing. And fortunately, now our borders are getting a little bit more secure. They're at 96% cure at the southern border, but 90% of illegal fentanyl, 90% that's been caught at the borders. So I think and I'll end there, Mr. Chair, but I think it's worthy to say, and I'd be remiss to say, if we weren't thankful for the president today who secured the border, where most of this fentanyl was coming over through Canada and Mexico from China, who produces it, into our country. No matter what you think of our president, you have to at least acknowledge that a secure border that stops the flow of fentanyl, which is killing Americans, has to be recognized and thanked. Mr. Chair, thank you.
Representative Knutson, close out your bill.
Thank you, Chair. This is a no-brainer. Let's protect some kids and vulnerable adults. This should have been done a long time ago.
and aligning it with the penalties for methamphetamine exposure just makes sense. So
thank you, Representative Knutson. I will renew the motion to re-refer House File 897 to the Committee on Public Safety, where you can continue the conversation we had today where it belongs. Thank you, Representative Knutson.
Okay. Thank you, everyone.
Representative Coulter, you ready? All right. Well, I mean, I didn't really give you much warning, so you're okay. You did a bad job, but you got to get after me if things are going to fall.
We didn't vote.
What?
We didn't vote on that bill. Well, but that's okay. We can vote now.
We're going to move on now. Thank you. So, all those in favor of sending House File 897, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Now the bill is out of here. All right. Representative Coulter, would you like to move your bill?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me get my act together here a little bit. So I will move House File 2617 be before the committee. We do have a DE1 as well. I will move the DE1.
Representative Coulter moves the DE1. In the interest of time, where I think we'll just quick, any member section? Let's get into, okay. All those in favor, the DE1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. The bill is in the shape the author would wish it. I have a question for the author. Why was this bill so late to the agenda? I mean, this is unacceptable. All right, go ahead with your presentation, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I am excited. And honestly, that's not something you often hear when we talk about childcare licensing. And we've all had enough conversations about it to know why that is. But truly, House File 2617 as amended is a game changer. It offers us the chance to chart a new path forward on childcare licensing that treats providers like the educators that they are, that we all know they are, while balancing important health and safety regulations. I want to begin, first of all, by thanking my co-authors, Representative Nadeau and Chair Katiza Witoon. And really, I want to invite all of you to join us on this effort. There is room for everybody on this committee to sign on as a co-author. You know, I think we all agree, we've had lots of conversations as a committee, we all agree that the current approach to childcare licensing is simply not working for providers. And more importantly, that means it's not working for our families and for our kids. And much of that difficulty is based on the fact that childcare exists in this sort of weird nexus between education and human services. And there have been efforts over the years, we've even heard some bills in this committee, that have sort of tried to tinker around the edges and attempt to balance health and safety with quality. And the reality is that the current licensing structure that we use in this state inhibits that. And it feels like, you know, every attempt that comes forward either moves too far in one direction or the other, or doesn't move in any direction well enough and is more or less rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. And there are a few reasons for that. Primarily, I think it's because we rely on licensing simply for too much, both in terms of on-the-ground conditions and the people responsible for the education itself. Accessibility and understanding of regulations is incredibly difficult, and it takes away from everyone because everyone is responsible for it. And our system currently is built around a more of a punitive approach instead of a supportive one. So it's small wonder that professionals who get paid poorly get out of a business that treats them poorly. House File 2617 gets at some immediate challenges around interpretive guidance and operating procedures and county oversight of family child care licenses, while also setting us on a path forward that focuses on the basics, freeing up providers to serve our kiddos, looks to industry standards for quality, and delivers support rather than only doling out punishment. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn things over to my wonderful testifiers.
All right, we have three testifiers on the list. We'll start with Kaylee Spencer, and if Karin Swenson can also just come up and sit so we can move swimmingly along.
Yeah, I can move too.
Thank you for joining us. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair West and members of the committee. My name is Kaylee Spencer, and I am the director of Lakeside Early Learning, a child care center in Duluth, Minnesota. I am here in support of HF 2617, which takes important steps toward reforming the child care licensing system. I am grateful to the bill's co-authors, Representatives Nadeau, Coulter, and Katiza Watun. While regulations are essential to ensuring health and safety, the current system often penalizes providers for minor technical mistakes that have no bearing on child safety or well-being. For example, this past summer, we received a citation for a clerical error on a staff person's orientation record. The staff member had completed all necessary training prior to caring for children, but due to missing the date of the training and a signature on the form, it resulted in a citation. During an earlier visit, a teacher was required to remove their entire play kitchen due to a missing knob. The missing piece did not leave any sharp edges or hazards and was simply cosmetic. Yet again, it resulted in a citation that stated program materials were not in good repair. I have dedicated my career to providing high-quality care for children, and I am deeply passionate about creating an environment that is both safe and welcoming. However, the current licensing system often distracts us from this mission by focusing on technicalities that have little to no impact on child safety. Instead of penalizing providers over small, non-safety-related issues, we need a system that fosters collaboration, provides clear guidance, and supports continuous growth, which we can achieve by separating health and safety from quality, a system where we can focus on what truly matters, ensuring children's well-being and giving our teachers the tools they need to succeed. HF 2617 is an important step in the right direction, and I urge the committee to support it. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you for your testimony. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair West and committee members. My name is Karen Swenson. I'm the executive director of Meadow Park Preschool and Child Care Center in Rochester, Minnesota. And I've been in this field for 40 plus years. I'm testifying in support of House File 2617. We need to reform our child care system, which has become overly punitive rather than supportive of providers. I want to thank our co-authors, Nathan Coulter, Rep. Katiza Watun, and Rep. Nadeau for bringing this forward. We really appreciate that. Our current system too often operates under a got-you mentality. Providers live in fear of citations, not because we don't care, but because regulations can be inconsistent, difficult to navigate, and are left up to the interpretation of a licensor. Instead of fostering improvement, this system drives good providers out, worsening our already critical shortage in childcare. Here are a couple of examples of citations I've received in the past. As I was updating my emergency preparedness plan, I had pulled it out of my indexed binder. Then the licensor walked in and cited me because it was not in my binder. Really, I was working on it. If you go to the Minnesota Child Care Lookup site, it says I was cited for the emergency preparedness plan was not included with other program policies and are given to parents, making it look like I hadn't done my job and did not have an emergency preparedness plan. Second example, we are required to have documentation that staff have received orientation. As part of that training, new staff members are required to have 30 minutes of abusive head trauma training. But because I didn't write 30 minutes in a tiny little box on my form, I was cited for, here again, Staff orientation training did not include all required items. So here again.
We actually totally agree with you and we're very supportive, but we do need to keep going. So if you could wrap up.
I'll go quick. So as stated in bill language, licensing should be about health and safety, and that's where our focus should be. Things like sanitation, learning environment, child interactions, et cetera. And curriculum and learning environment and what's happening in the classroom and that apps should be regulated by accreditation via standards. Let's support providers and teachers with teams to help them. We need them supported. And our focus should be on the deep bonding relationships the children in our care deserve. I urge the committee to support this bill, ensuring that providers can succeed in delivering the quality care our communities depend on. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Christina Valdez is the last testifier on the list. If you are here to testify on this bill, we are done with the list, but please go ahead and sit right up there so we can move on to you if you are here to testify further. If there is no one else after this, we will close public testimony on this bill. Thanks for coming. Please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair West and members of the committee. My name is Christina Killian Valdez, and I'm the director of Listos Preschool and Childcare in Rochester. As the director of a small nonprofit center, I want to thank you for your work on behalf of Minnesota's children and ask that you keep it going. I want to express my gratitude to Representatives Coulter, Nadeau, and Cartiza Watun for co-authoring House File 2617, which is a great step forward. We're fortunate to have bold, proactive elected officials who created the new Department of Children, Youth, and Families. Now I'm calling on you to take that same proactive approach to modernizing the childcare licensing system. As we move away from the Department of Human Services, we should also leave behind the old, outdated childcare licensing system of Rule 3. As it stands, Minnesota's regulatory system is filled with repetitive, excessive paperwork, inconsistent rule interpretations, and inflexible policies that make it hard to run programs. These regulations haven't kept up with brain research and don't support childcare providers in doing our best work. During our most recent licensing visit, Listos was cited for what is listed as hazardous objects were accessible to children. In reality, that morning a family had replenished their preschool child's bathroom wipes with a new package by leaving it in the child's cubby. This licensing violation is published on the DHS website, which lists all of our violations for 5 years. The latest DHS proposed licensing drafts don't change the issue. Those are band-aids that create more confusion and work for licensors and childcare programs. That's why this bill is so important. It separates licensing for health and safety from licensing for quality. Learning-rich environments where children can safely explore, play, create, and thrive cannot be validated by a checklist during a random inspection. Our program maintains a 4-star parent aware rating, works closely with coaches from School Readiness and the Center for Inclusive Childcare. We're also ready to begin the national accreditation process. So this bill is a critical step toward building a regulatory system that supports that work. By working together as childcare educators, families, and government officials, and keeping children at the heart of this work, we can transform the system in bold, positive ways. I urge you to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Public testimony is now closed on this bill, and we'll move on to member questions. Any members? Representative Zalesnikar.
Thank you, Chair West, and thank you, Representative, for this bill and for the testifiers today. I think anything that we can do to separate the inconsequential things, anyone that's been through a survey, and I spent 30 years in a surveyed atmosphere, and my concern has always been that childcare is mirroring the type of punitive environment that happened in the nursing homes and assisted living that could be coaching. And I think that is a hardship for the employees and for the leadership team because they work so hard to do great things every day. And it's not captured in a day survey or a couple hour survey. And these items that are on their record for the website and on DHS and things become a go-to for families that don't have the scope and a perspective to know what they're really looking at as we listen to the providers outline that. So I commend you for doing this. I think it's a great bill. We're going in the right direction, and we have more work to do, but I think we need to start somewhere. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lesnikar. Representative Nadeau.
And I'll be quick, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Coulter. I think you've done some really great things in here with accreditation, with taking license regulations and focusing them on health and safety, creating that more of that handshake between providers and the agencies, and the way that you allowed me to contribute to this. I really appreciate that, and I'm happy to support it today. So thank you.
Yeah, Representative Coulter, I will say this is an incredible bill that shows you really put the effort in to engage Representative Nadeau and other members and the groups. It is a beautiful collection of support you'll find within your packets that may surprise you. That is very rare, and this is some of the stuff Chair Katizwa-Tun and I both strongly support doing in our committee. It's just common sense. It's sad that it's so hard for us to do common sense, I would say, but we do have to be careful as we move forward. But I would argue we have edged on being too careful with the regulations we observe, and I think this is a great path forward. And I did not, Representative Sensenmura, I neglected to look at the list for you, so go right ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Coulter, for bringing this bill. I'm wondering if you can just talk to me about what the difference is between accreditation and licensing and kind of how that would work. Thank you.
Representative Coulter.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Sensenmura. So I do have a phone-a-friend here if you're looking for more sort of technical description. Now I'm looking for the language in the bill to make sure I'm not talking out of turn here. But in essence, the concept would be that the standards for like program rigor and I'm not finding the word right now, but it would be something that would be set forward by national organizations rather than something that's put into state law and state rules. But I think Ms. Moss can say that better than I can.
Ms. Moss.
Thank you, Chair West. Erica Moss from Think Small and Representative Sensenmura. So in this model, childcare licensing is narrowed to focus on health and safety. The things that are explicitly listed in the bill and which the testifiers referenced. So looking at facilities, health and hygiene, age of staff, ratios, background checks, things like that. Right now in our current licensing system, there are also all kinds of indicators that the testifiers mentioned. Do you have a play kitchen? How many sets of blocks do you have? Things like that. Those wouldn't be part of licensing anymore. Because there are better, more holistic ways to look at quality in a childcare program than looking whether there are these particular materials present. It's 2025. There are all kinds. There are measures of the interactions between adults and children in a program. There are measures of the environment where children are. And those standards are most appropriately rest with professionals in the field, like they do in other industries. And so an association, for example, like the National Family Child Care Association, it's family child care providers. They've come up with their own standards, their own accreditation for what quality looks like in a family child care program. And so looking to that organization or the National Association for the Education of Young Children, many programs choose to seek that accreditation as a validation by their peers, other professionals in the field, of the quality that they provide. And so that would be the separation, and that would pretty dramatically alter what's in child care licensing right now. Thank you.
Representative Sensenmura.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, that's helpful. And then just wondering, and I apologize if this was talked about, are there other states that kind of have this model, and what have we seen from other states in terms of satisfaction with programs, quality of programs, cost of childcare? Thank you.
Yeah. Ms. Moss.
Yeah, Chair West and Representative Sensenmura, that's a great question. Little plug, Think Small, the organization I work for is having a webinar presentation on Friday where someone from the state of Connecticut will be presenting. In Connecticut, they are using national accreditation, like I described, for their definition of quality. And while they have not pared back licensing regulations to the same degree as is presented in this bill, they've been very intentional about including only in their licensing things that are precursors to build on with accreditation. So that might be having a plan, and then when you work through accreditation, you have a more detailed plan. So Connecticut would be an example of a state. The state of Indiana uses national standards as well. I believe Florida does as well. So there are several states moving in this direction. And then, of course, across the country, you see child care regulations. There's a wide array. But I think we hold ratios are still part of this. I think that that's the quality piece. There are a few pieces that are really important and foundational to health and safety and to quality. Ratios would be an example of that, and that would remain in licensing.
Representative Sensenmura.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And last question. So I know that we've talked a little bit about a kind of a process that the department was doing around revised licensing standards. How would this bill kind of interact with that process? Thank you.
Representative Coulter.
Yeah, thank you. And just briefly, Representative Sensenmura, to your previous question, I think another way to sort of think about it is, you know, we don't license colleges and universities, for example, in the state of Minnesota. We rely on national higher education accreditation, so it'd be something similar to that. To answer this question, I view this as more of a bridge to sort of, a bridge that, oh boy, tortured metaphor alert here. It's a bridge that turns the road. transportation was in here before, it's fine. So I see it as a connection to sort of that next step in the regulation modernization process, but one I think that will hopefully steer it in a direction that is going to work better for everybody involved.
Ms. Moss.
Mr. Chair, if I may, Representative Sensenmura, I think another way of thinking about it is this bill is providing a scope to the modernization project that hadn't been previously provided. And so that project started, and they just continued with the kind of scope that licensing has now. This bill sort of defines that scope, narrows that scope somewhat, but in keeping with the direction that the project is going, and I think that there are aspects that could also be used, differential monitoring, weighted risk, all of those things would still apply. It's just about what are the regulations going to be, what is the scope of the regulations.
Representative Sensenmura.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I would just say we've heard a lot of feedback from providers that, you know, that draft version was not the right direction. So anything that steers and bridges and changes the road, I'm for. Thank you.
Yes, this bill is very good about finally getting us in that direction, which is where I think we all want to be, where licensors are focusing on what they truly understand, and the experts who actually work in the industry are focused on the quality of the, and we just set the standards, the base level standards of that. I do have a question, though. The section 4, the background study liaison. So one thing I've heard from providers is we get no information from background studies outside of qualified, unqualified. What exactly are the roles and vision for this particular position? Like, what tangible value do they offer providers? Ms. Moss.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I might have to phone a friend to the phone a friend. but my understanding is that a lot of times providers are waiting for the result of a background study, and there's a little bit of a black box where they don't know where that is in the process, and they're trying not to lose a candidate that they want to hire because the background study is incomplete. And so they need better visibility, and this would give them that visibility.
State your name for the record.
Courtney Greiner. Thank you, Chair West. I am a provider. I own a center in Esco, Minnesota. I also work with providers across the state. And background checks are incredibly complicated. And so providers really struggle with out of state or where is this in the process? What is holding this back? And we don't always have opportunity to reach somebody. And so this would create that direct connection to background checks. It doesn't take away the waiting or the unfortunately, but it does at least give us an idea of where we are in line and where we are in that hopper of what needs to be done, what's next to move that along to get those people into the classrooms as soon as we can.
Yeah. Thank you. Okay, that is really helpful because I was wondering what that exactly does. I was also stunned to see the first thing when I was reading this bill the other day was we don't have standard operating procedure for licensing visits. It's like, well, what have we been doing this whole time? That was relatively shocking. And this is great that we're moving in a direction of standardization so people know what to expect. Also, I'm sure it makes it more efficient for the inspectors. Thank you for bringing this bill. Representative Coulter, would you like to close out?
Yes, please. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to all the testifiers and to committee members. You know, I was thinking about the conversations that we've had in this committee and around licensing, and often those conversations have sort of focused on the monetary costs. And, you know, I think we've kind of come to this place where we understand that there's not really a sort of direct monetary savings by building a better licensing system. And I think that's okay, because what we're doing with this bill is making sure that we are centering the joy of serving Minnesota families and kids in this work. And by doing that, by making sure that our providers can focus on doing that, we're going to keep more providers in the business in the first place. And it's going to be just easier for everybody all the way around. And that's going to bring down costs. And more importantly, it's going to show that we know how important the work that providers do is. And when we remember the fact that 80% of brain development happens by age 3 and 90% happens by age 5, what could be more important? Thank you.
Well said. Representative Coulter renews his motion to lay over House File 2617 as amended. Now, oh, it's me.
The next item on our agenda is House File 2305. This will be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Chair West, would you like to move your bill and get it before the committee?
So I'll move House File 2305 to be before the committee to be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. This bill requires if there's a maltreatment, a finding of maltreatment and investigation of a licensed provider, that they will have to post that license maltreatment violation for 10 years rather than the normal 5. This was a bill brought to me by a family that I met in my meetings as going into all this maltreatment stuff because of my situation. And you realize how many people are involved. And they had a child named Nolan, which was very strange, and that this is the second family I met with a child who's abused in daycare named Nolan. It's very shocking. And that child was actually in a family care situation, and they were shaken and have permanent brain damage. Their prosecutor eventually got at least a one-year sentence for the individual, but one thing that they felt very strongly about is when a maltreatment investigation concludes, that they think it should be treated more severely than, you know, what we heard from the testifiers just previously. Like, there's a missing wheel in your truck. There's a missing door on your KitchenAid product. This, I think, is the beginning of a discussion on that, because we don't want to put too much onerous burden on providers. We want to make their lives easier. And we, in the spirit of the last bill, we want to focus on health and safety and less on other factors that are better suited for other entities to regulate. So that is the bill. It's relatively simple. And I would just like it up for consideration as we assemble our omnibus bill in the near future.
Okay. Thank you. Is there any public testimony? Seeing none, let's go to member questions. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative West. This bill is far from simple, but I don't have a ton of questions. I have one general question. We're adding the new department into basically inserting them everywhere, as far as foster care,
Sorry to interrupt you, but you are looking at the wrong bill.
Oh.
This bill.
I'm sorry.
Is this
I was
big.
On 2551. Sorry. Sorry, Mr. Chair.
Representative Nadeau withdraws his comments. Any other questions? Seeing none, Chair West, if you would like any final comments.
House File 2305, I think, is a good beginning of a discussion for this kind of thing. It's strange that I love Representative Coulter's bill so much. I'm still acclimating to what that feels like, but it is the goal I have for this. See, this is what's fun about a committee at the end of the day. And I actually appreciate that everyone who has been a part of this committee and even the department and other entities have realized that it's okay to have a little fun when you're doing serious business. But this bill is about ensuring that families know exactly what has gone on or at a provider over a longer term. And really what I like about it is it elevates what we should care about the most, which is maltreatment, above the litany of other concerns. And this is the direction, maybe not this particular bill, but this is the direction that our committee will go, and I'm very encouraged. And we're about to enter into an interesting time where we assemble our budget. And it is gonna be remarkably challenging, but it's encouraging. Today, we do agree on some regulatory changes that can help, and that is where we want the committee to end, in a place that makes it easier, more affordable for providers, accessible for parents, and actually makes government look good when it does work. That's the goal. Chair Katizbontun and I are absolutely going to kill it as we assemble our omnibus budget bill. I just know it. We just have to defeat the Senate, which I have confidence in us. So, without further ado, I will renew my motion to lay over House File 2305 for possible inclusion in a later omnibus bill.
All right, 2305 is laid over. The next bill will be 2551, and Chair Katiza and we will refer to Judiciary, and I will turn this back over to Nolan.
Chair Katizawatoon, great to see you so far away. Would you like to move your bill?
Trading places here, Mr. Chair. Yes, I would like to move that House File 2551 be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary. And Mr. Chair and members, this is probably the most exciting bill that we have had before the committee all session. I'm just kidding. It's a recodification bill that allows us to move existing statute from departments where our jurisdiction has been previously housed into DCYF, obviously the new department. And I think that Representative Nadeau might have had some comments, but really all this does is finish the transfer from other departments to DCYF and reconnect basically pieces that might have come apart in statute if not for the inclusion of DCYF in the new statute. So that's what it does.
Thank you, Chair Katiz-Watoon. Is the department here for a quick question I have? Yes, there we go. Oh, she. I love the level of enthusiasm. That is what this committee is all about.
She's back.
So it's my understanding the department needs this bill to function, and it has a lot of duties that are currently being done, but now need to be relabeled under the Department of Children and Families. And I scoured this for secret evil plots and plans, which I'm very suspicious of, but I neglected to find any. So would you willingly tell us of any nefarious plots within this bill? Or, but also, yes, I would like to confirm that that is indeed the case. Ms. Sommerfeld, please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you. I failed to do that earlier. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jennifer Sommerfeld, the Department of Children, Youth, and Families. And no, we don't have any nefarious plots in here. I can confirm that we did not actually draft this bill. This is a revisor's bill recodification that's predominantly conforming changes. There were some things that the revisor's office could not do through the legislative instruction last year would be, like, for example, to add us to the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council. They could replace us, but not add us. And so this bill just cleans up some of those things. But I believe that the revisor's office did not insert anything nefarious into it.
No, Chair Katiza and I had a good meeting with the revisor, to which they reiterated that 2,551 times, probably. We will now move. Any member of the public here to testify on House File 2551? Seeing none, I'll close public testimony and move on to member questions. Representative Nadeau.
Now I'm in order, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And so this is a very technical bill, and thank you. But so I understand where we would be adding DCYF to a lot of these things, especially and leaving the Department of Human Services where we need to for medical assistance. But it's just adding DCYF everywhere. And I'm wondering why, if we're having a new department, why aren't we eliminating access to certain data programs and all these other things that are in here? Why aren't we removing the Department of Human Services where we can?
Ms. Sommerfeld.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe actually that's likely already the case where we only need one agency to have access to data, but a lot of the work that we do still crosses both agencies, right? There are chemical dependency programs and things that go through SSIS and through other programs. There's data that's shared amongst them. That might not be the best example, but I think we are added where we need to all have data, and in places where we only need one agency to have it, I'm assuming last year or through conforming changes over the summer, that was changed.
Representative Doe.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that. It just seems overbearing. I mean, I voted to build this department, and part of it was is that, and I understand that there's sometimes we have to pay for things twice in government while we innovate and do something different. But you know, I've heard that DHS FTEs are not going down, MDE FTEs are not going down, and now here's a revisor's bill that isn't moving the authority from these reporting agencies solely to the department, and I just wonder why are we doing this? I mean, I'm concerned with this. I mean, if we can't find better service to kids and youth and families under this department, where we still have to rely on DHS, and I get it. I mean, I get the eligibility programs, I get the dual generational approach, but it goes against the argument that we made 2 years ago about creating a new department that was focused on these families. And I'm just worried that we're building bigger government, and maybe this isn't the place for that, Mr. Chair, but I'm concerned.
Chair Katiza Batun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for sharing your concerns, Representative Nadeau. I think, this is just kind of a required statutory update in this transition, and I think that when we created the department 2 years ago, we kind of took that vote to expand government. State government, right, to better serve the children, youth, and families of the state of Minnesota. Not moving on these changes
limits us in our ability to do that. And I think that, you know, you're right, probably down the line, after the transition is complete, you know, later on this year, maybe then we can start looking at some of those pieces where now that DCYF is fully functioning, does it make sense? Should we, you know, down the line, maybe remove some of the other duplicative potentially pieces that are in this recodification statute, then that would probably be the time to do it. But I think that this is necessary for the department to continue and complete the transition process, and then potentially we'll be able to find some of those efficiencies down the line.
Representative Doe.
And thank you. And this would be my final comment. And what kind of stuck out to me is that we're adding the Commissioner of Children, Youth, and Families to existing program requirements requiring foster parent liability insurance. And the same thing is for, you know, foster homes. I mean, we should be eliminating, I mean, that the regulatory requirements that we put on people that serve individuals are extreme. And I just wish that we would, you know, look at this and say, can we make it easier on providers? Can they make, I mean, we should have a portal that I would suggest that the state has where it you know, our providers get to submit the documents that we require. And it's massive, where it comes in and they don't have to, you know, now they have to supply this to, you know, DHS, and now it's DCYF. Not that it's a huge thing, but they stack up. I mean, everyone, it's insurance, it's affirmative action, it's all of the things that we require in contracts. So, and I'll leave it at that. I sound angry, I'm not. I just wish it were, I wish it were more, you know, streamlined. I wish that we would, you know, look hard at where can we reduce the burden on the providers. At the same time, we're saying we're doing this so we can function as government. Well, we've got a lot of partners out there that we make it hard on. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Nadeau, I do agree. I have a crushing feeling we're not doing enough. But making law is very difficult. And once we're done, we're going to work through this budget. And the entire second year of this biennium, I think we're going to be dedicated to making life easier for providers and parents, especially because the modernization input will be done. We're going to have to deal with that, and that's going to be a huge part of it. Representative Chair Katizwa-Toon, we always have to go late because that's what we do here. Would you like to? I actually think you need to remove your bill, too. I don't know if we
yes.
did that.
Oh, yes. So we do need to vote. Mr. Chair, I would ask members to support the transition to judiciary so we can take a look at all the data privacy issues over there, and appreciate the green vote.
Chair Katizwa-Toon renews her motion to refer House File 2551 to the Committee on Judiciary. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails, and the bill is on its way to judiciary. Thanks for coming, everybody, today. Great bill. Have a good day, and the committee is adjourned.